There we go.
Why did the... Oh, fudge. Well, that's a start. It could have been worse.
It could have been so much worse. And I just suddenly realised it. We were just reminiscing about Animal Crossing, which I didn't play. And my story of gaming in lockdown was it was definitely March. It was as things were starting to close down. And I was getting this sense of like, okay, there's going to be some time at home. And I went down to the local high street. It was when you could like, you had stalls selling hand sanitizer for like £15 for 100 mils. Because that was when everyone thought that was going to stop it. I went into it's actually secondhand like gaming and electronics store. And I was like, right, I'm just going to buy a bunch of games. And I was like, okay, I will now finally play Dark Souls and Ratchet and Clank. And I'd actually messaged a friend of mine who was a much more of like a console gamer than me and said, what games do I get? That I like? What are the last 10 years of games? And he's like, get Dark Souls, get these Ratchet and Clanks. I think I can't think what it's called. It's whichever, there's like a, it's going to come to me. It's the one that it's a military one, and it's the one that just has this horrible like twist to it where you go, oh, this is really dark, but knowing what the twist was didn't hit me quite in the same way, but it's still very good. And my friends are like, I'm enjoying Paul playing 10-year-old games. But I spent probably, well, like 24 hours actual game time in Dark Souls and got through like 10% and then quit.
The contrast between your what you wanted to play during lockdown and what I wanted to play during lockdown is very very contrasting. I wanted to play nice, fuzzy, good feel games, and you went and played Dark Souls, which, for folks who don't know, it is one of the darkest, most difficult games out there. From a skills perspective, I gave it a go twice. Twice I cried, and I didn't want to do it anymore. And actually, recently my partner was again like, because I think he was watching some videos of people playing Dark Souls for the first time, which are, by the way, amazing to watch. And he's like, "You should give Dark Souls another go." And I'm like, "Do you really want me to do that? Yeah. Like, don't you remember the last two times? If anything, you should be encouraging me to try Elden Ring again, because Elden Ring, at least there is, you know, a lot of, it's still very dark, but at least it's from the same developer, so it's a very similar sort of feeling
as from software.
Like, there are some incredibly there are some really grotesque things in there as well, but there's also a lot of like just exploring and looking around and going like, wow, look at the pretty tree. But yeah, and I'm like, hey, that's a very strange game to keep on pushing me to try to play. But I think watching people struggle through it and then succeeding at some point, because we do at some point,
yeah,
given enough time, I think that's also like the gratifying thing as someone who can play those games, to watch them and go like, wow, like, good job you. It's like,
Maybe
not now.
No, I agree. And I mean, Dark Souls, it wasn't the darkness of the game, it was just how insanely hard it is. The game I couldn't think of, by the way, is Spec Ops The Line, which anyone who's played it will know exactly what I'm talking about. There's I'm not going to spoil it, but there's like one thing that happens about halfway through that I knew about, and it always crops up in the like lists. Where it's like the 10 worst things that games made you do kind of lists. And then it actually also has a twist at the end that I didn't know about. That I was like, oh, okay, this is actually when you first start playing it, you think is a run-of-the-mill, like, third-person shooter. It absolutely has that, but the story is, there's a lot more to it than that, which I was like, oh, okay, this is cool. And then Ratchet and Clank, which is like throwaway fun.
That's a feel good.
That's a great. Yeah,
again,
yeah.
It's quite difficult if you don't have a lot of experience with those type of games. But again, it's an animated feel good game, which again, between all of the three above that you mentioned, like when you are feeling a little bit down because the world is shutting down and you don't know what's going to happen, you know, strange choices, definitely. I would have loved to talk to you at that point to see where your brain was at, because
I think it was more that I'm never gonna have the time to do this again, maybe, like, that was some of it, and just a sheer thing of like, hey, I should play this through. It's similarly when I decided like a year ago that I was like, hey, maybe now is the time to play Alien Isolation, and I've realized that, like you saying, you like watching people play Dark Souls, probably because I remember when I was like 12 going round to my next door neighbour's house watching them play Resident Evil and Dino Crisis. I enjoy watching people play survival horror games a lot more than I enjoy playing them, because they're actually just really frustrating.
Oh no, especially older games. Like I remember, like I had a conversation with my dad about this when it comes to, like, because he's also like an avid gamer, and talking about like this weird phenomena of like enjoying watching other people play games. I think especially as I'm getting older, and like the less time I have to game myself, the more I actually watch other people play games, because exactly, like, I won't get to do this at any time soon, so why don't I just have it in the background whilst I'm doing something else that I would enjoy a lot more nowadays. You know, for example, like I was watching someone play a game whilst I was like doing my Lego set. Like I didn't feel compelled to play the game, but I would love to see it. So, you know, I know it's this really like weird, like, you know, oh, young people, they don't play games anymore, they just watch them. Genuinely, there is a use case for that, and I feel absolutely nothing bad about it. And they are games that, it's not that I would watch instead of play. Like, I would just never play this game if I don't watch it. Like, that this is the closest I will get to playing this game.
And it's also, like I said, it's not a new thing. It's a new doing it online, and again, but like, again, I grew up in that thing of single player games. The way you would play it, like GTA, you'd play it, and it'd be like, okay, you're going to play until you die. And then, instead of like four of you, one person plays until they dies, and then the next person has a go. It's that, like, so you kind of would have that, but most of the time was spent watching other people play games. It wasn't playing games yourself.
See, on the other hand, and I'm gonna sound very lonely, but I didn't have a lot of friends that were playing games growing up. Like, the only person I had around me that was doing that was dad. So I got to, like, and especially because we only had one PC as I was growing up, it was very much of a me sitting over his shoulder, like just counting down like the minutes he has told me that he's gonna, and like, and obviously, like, when he says like, oh, well, you know, it will be your turn like soon, that soon felt like forever.
Yeah.
But I did get to do a lot of that as well, and especially like some of the games he was playing, like I just again, I was a kid, I didn't have the skill set to actually play it, but like things like Splinter Cell, like, was one of the things he was really like really into, and I have vivid memories of that game as if I was playing them, but in reality it was me watching dad play them. Mm-hmm. Like, there's some like scenes that I remember from the game. Same was with the Heroes 3, right?
Yeah,
this is like really like throwback.
Yeah.
But Heroes 3 was also one of them, because I didn't have the strategic like mind at the time to play, but I could help with, like, again, like one of my fondest memories with my mom was that like she loved playing Heroes 3. Her English was not at like the same level as mine was at the time, so I would translate things for her. So she would like find an item and she would go like, oh, what does it say? And I would like, again, so I genuinely got that feeling that I was playing a game, even though it wasn't me making the decisions. And mom was brilliant in the strategic part, which was the English that was like, you know, her struggle at the time. And there wasn't a translate, like, I think nowadays you can get it translated, like, especially Heroes 3, you can get it in any language, like, in the world. But at the time, it was just in English, and that was the version we had. But it was so, so good fun. What was the first game you actually remember playing?
Oh, that's a good question. What was the first game?
What's the first thing that comes to your mind as a memory?
If I think back, so the thing I remember seeing being played, and I probably did play, was GoldenEye. I have a very distinct memory of playing, there was, when we brought a PlayStation, when you used to buy consoles, you'd get a demo disc of playing a demo, and I probably still have that demo disc, actually, and it had a demo for Metal Gear Solid on it, and it was literally the bit from when the game opens. So anyone that's played it, if you haven't played it, how have you not played Metal Gear Solid? Go and play Metal Gear Solid, or go and watch a playthrough of Metal Gear Solid.
I haven't.
Go. Have you seen the playthrough?
I think it was. Well, no. Keep in mind, I think it was for the longest time. I think it was PlayStation only, or like.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
I never owned a console until I had the Switch bought for me in 2020. So I've been I'm a true through and through gamer.
Playing that, there was a game as well on that called Cooler World, which I urge you to look up, and we will link in the show notes, which is just like bouncing a ball between platforms, but it's the most addictive game I can describe. So there was those, and then, so it's a bit of a mishmash. I remember those ones. I remember Age of Empires 2, The Age of Kings, so pre-expansion pack, and then when the expansion pack came out, go, this is so cool. And FIFA 2000, which would be like around 99. So again, that was kind of, we didn't get it, we got our first console when I was like 8 or 9, so it was those, that's kind of when my memories really come from. And then it's like things like, I remember when we brought our first Tomb Raider game I remember buying it, and it was right around, it was Tomb Raider 4, and it was right around when the Game Boy Advance was like the brand new thing at the time. And I would kind of have memories of like being in the store and that being new. And I remember buying, I tell you what, the first PS2 game I played, I can tell you that, because we had the choice of getting two, you could get two games, one of two games with it. You could get Hitman. Bear in mind, I was 12 at the time. You could get Hitman,
yep.
Or you could get Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time.
Oh, that is a good one. So did you get the Prince of Persia?
Of course. And I then got stuck.
Of course. Good.
In the, like, great hall bit for... I rage quit that. It's when you have to, like, jump around the... There's like a bit you have to like jump.
Is that the pillars?
The pillars. Yeah. Jumping from the pillars. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Could not get past it for ages, and then one day went back and did it and just did it, and that was my first experience of what has since become known as all you had to do was follow the damn train CJ syndrome, which is a very early mission that no matter how it just seems to be pure luck. Completing it.
I have some memories of GTA as well, but so I don't count like the my very earliest memories of someone brought in an Atari and I was doing like the shooting of like ducks.
Yeah,
like I don't count that because like I was so little. I don't think I knew what I was doing. The first conscious sitting down and playing games was on a PC. So again, we didn't have a console at home. It was, and I don't know which one was first, but it was either Stronghold, which again dictates a lot of the games I play nowadays. It was either Stronghold or Sacred, which is a Diablo clone.
Mm-hmm,
so we didn't actually have, you know, it was a, you know, the Diablo we had at home.
Yeah. Yeah.
You don't need to buy Diablo. We have Diablo at home, and Diablo at home was Sacred, which is just a clone, which was still great. And by the way, like a lot of my love for fantasy nowadays was because of that game.
I'm sure.
Because I remember, like the character I loved playing the most was like an elven chick, and she was magnificent. She had a bow. She had like this long blonde hair, like long elven legs, right? And I was just like, and I remember like little me looking at this and going like, man, like I want to be like a bow wielding, horse riding, like badass. Like do that, and like it was incredibly, like it really dictated like my like adoration I have for fantasy nowadays. It all started from Sacred, which again, looking back at it now, it's a subpar game at best.
Mm-hmm.
I tried even like they had like a new version coming out. It was so broken that I couldn't even install it. But that's a story for another time. But it was genuinely like Sacred, Stronghold. And then Heroes of Might and Magic 3. And then at some point, and I think I dropped it for a long time. Like there was a period of my time, of my life, that I didn't really play games all that much. And then at one point, Dad was playing the first Assassin's Creed. And when I saw I think he was doing like, for folks that haven't played Assassin's Creed, it's like this beautiful, they tried to recreate historical locations, but they put in a lot of effort at the time, you know, Ubisoft of bygone days, they put in a lot of effort of creating these beautiful environments.
Yeah.
And especially the first game was practically, where is it? Actually, I'm going to lie to you now, location wise, but it was somewhere in the Middle East.
It was a
location that it was so separated from what I have seen in my life. It was like one of the cities of Jerusalem. Right, so it was such a different environment from what I was used to and have grown up in that it was genuine. It felt like I dived into a world that I didn't know and I hadn't seen before, and it was so, you know, again, at the moment looking back at it, it's not the best graphics, but at the time it was so beautiful. And I remember Dad was doing like the you discovered the map via climbing like a tower and jumping off it,
yeah.
And that was the first thing I saw of him climbing up this tower. The sounds of it, the effects of it, was beautiful. And then you drop, you jump. And you hear the eagle effect of you jumping, like the leap of faith. And it was like, oh my God, this is beautiful. I have a very funny story, by the way, to tell you about like Assassin's Creed. Because after Assassin's Creed 1, obviously Assassin's Creed 2 came out, and it was in Venice.
That's the first one I played.
And I spent an unholy amount of time of that game. Like I might have clocked in 1,000 hours in that game easily, because I loved it so much. I was doing all the side quests. I was collecting all of the collectibles. Like I genuinely adored that game. And when I had the chance at 8th grade to go to Venice, like Old Town Venice, and we were a group of, it was me and a group of other classmates, all super nerds, right? And we got lost in Old Town Venice because like the group was doing like the really touristy things, and we're like, no, we're gonna just go down this little side road. We navigated Venice via the experience we had in Assassin's Creed 2. I'm not joking.
I'm sure.
It sounds so strange, but genuinely, they made it so realistic and so, like, obviously, like, they were using topology maps and, like, maps of all the buildings and everything. It wasn't one-to-one, but it was enough for us to be able to navigate and say, like, oh, and we would say wild things like, oh, I've been on this roof, right? Yeah. I remember killing a guy over there.
Yeah. I stabbed someone in the neck here.
It was so strange.
Yeah, exactly.
And it was so strange to say these things, but we had the time of our lives. It was so great because we genuinely felt like we were actually in the game. It's the really unfortunate part of, like, I think, obviously, you know, I don't even want to go down this rabbit hole, but Ubisoft have definitely strained away from that magical creation that they had. Now I'm in a proper nostalgic mode.
I know, really. Oh, and you always blame me for being nostalgic, but maybe it's my influence.
I think at this point we've spoken enough that you're starting to get me really nostalgic. Which, by the way, nostalgic is not a bad feeling, right? But now I'm sort of sitting here going, like, you know what would be really nice? We should set up a LAN party and we're playing, like, Heroes 3.
I play Source Forge or Red Alert 2 or something like that.
See, like, I haven't played those. Oh, okay. Like, again, in my head, the only game that is worth playing like that is hot seating Heroes 3.
Okay.
Of, like, where you... And I get very fond memories of, like, playing with people together, and it's just like, stop looking at my screen.
Yeah.
It's my turn, like, you can't nowhere. Like, where are you on the map? It's like, no, stop looking. Like, are you up?
I'm going to say that it's people who maybe are a generation above us who do not experience this. I don't want to think about anyone younger not understanding this, but playing games in a split screen, so say you had four people playing a game and the screen would literally be split into four, but the knack was to watch what, like, your corner of the screen and also try and observe where on the map the other three people were, so that you could find them and kill them in the shooting games, or if it was a racing game, like, where were they on the track, or where were you going to try and lay the traps and where people lay traps.
Well, to be honest, like, Mario Kart still has that feeling because it still plays that way.
Yeah.
When you're on the couch play, you still have people, like, you know, with splitting the screen and, like, playing like that. You still have that same feeling of that, you know, what do you mean you're in first place? How are you in first place? I'm going to throw a banana at you now. Or a shell. We still have that because, like, obviously, like, especially since I've gotten the Nintendo Switch and we bought for my little sister, we bought that, and we're definitely now becoming I wouldn't say we're becoming a console family because there's still more PCs per person than consoles. I don't think my dad has still clocked in on the, you know, hasn't gotten into the idea of consoles. I've gotten to that point of being a PC trader that I now play most games I play with a controller. Mm-hmm. If they were intended, Dark Souls is a perfect example. Like, I would never try to play any of the Souls game without a controller. Mm-hmm. Like, it has to be a controller. Mm-hmm. But mind you, again, I learned to use a controller in 2020, which was, okay, story for another time, but God, what is it a painful experience.
I'm sure. The weirdest thing, and final thing for me on that, is, like, I always loved, like, real-time strategy, which play best on a PC. But one of my most played games, actually, on my PlayStation was Theme Park World, which you would not think would work that well on a console.
I would never play something like that.
I played hours of it, but I feel like now, if I went back and played it on a PC, it would be a revelation. But, you know, I still play Theme Hospital occasionally, because I think it's a great game. It's just, it's really hard, actually.
You have tried Two Point Hospital, right? Which is
the next
generation.
Yeah.
Two Point Hospital and Two Point Campus are magnificent.
Okay.
I highly recommend them if you're into that sort of thing, which my brain gets scratched in the best way possible with those games, because I don't get the chance to get really detailed,
mm-hmm.
but it gives me the right amount of detail to be happy with it, but still I can actually progress the game without spending 3 hours placing a plant somewhere.
I guess, final, just cherry on top of this conversation about, we started out and I was talking about how, oh, we know, I spent lockdown playing 10-year-old games. Do you remember, as well as Animal Crossing, the other game that everyone was playing during lockdown was Untitled Goose Game?
Doom! Oh, really?
No, Doom. Well, Doom.
I thought, no, because Doom came out.
Oh, Doom. Doom
came out. I remember. It was so lovely because Doom and Animal Crossing came out at about either the same day or the same week.
Yeah.
And there was a crossover event between the two. I love Doom. Doom is so great.
Oh, Doom is great. And like, I still think also OG Doom is great. Great soundtrack. Like, properly good soundtrack. But it was the Untitled Goose Game, which was obviously a game I started playing last year. And I went, oh, I should have played this when everyone else was. Because how the hell do I do half this stuff? But there we go.
It's a puzzle game about being a mean goose.
About being a goose. There's a honk button, which I just think is great.
Of course there's a honk button.
I feel like it's interesting. We've spent the last like half an hour talking about like tech and gaming, and it leads me quite nicely, as we do, right, into the kind of main topic of today, which has a title that I don't personally like this phrase, and I can explain why, but it's the one that everyone talks about, which is how you and me, Lydia, how we broke into tech.
Oh, I want to hear why you don't like broke into tech, because I also have not warm feelings about that phrase.
I think because it's...
So why do you not like the phrase breaking into tech?
Because it kind of implies that you're... Well, for two reasons. The first thing is it implies that there's a barrier between people and getting into this job, into this career path, right? It's mm-hmm. that you somehow have to, there is some kind of, you know, whether you want to think about it as a glass ceiling or a closed door, that you have to break in, you have to find a way in to do that. That's the first thing I don't like about it. The second thing is I don't think that it's not something you should look at in a way of going, hey, I want to break into that. It's a, how do I align what I do and how do I find a way to put my career on that path? And the last thing is because a lot of us didn't break into tech. We fell into tech.
We stumbled into tech ungracefully.
We tripped and fell. Rolled out the car. You're in tech now.
I think the breaking into tech, and I think this is where the term comes from. It reminds me of Hollywood, and I don't have warm feelings about Hollywood. Like, you break into Hollywood, you break into movies, you break into like this. I think I resonate a lot with what you said, because it almost feels like it's not meant to happen. Like, it's almost a lucky happenstance that you just happen to find a weaker door to break into, which I think applies heavily to Hollywood, right? Because there's a lot of people that want to get into Hollywood, but very few actually do. And it's usually people who have connections and, you know, pre-established, you know, let's say like their door is weaker to the pressure that they can just put in a little bit of pressure. I'm not saying that it's not still a lot of work. There's an enormous amount of work that goes through it. But that is when there is a huge amount of desire of, like, there's a huge amount of people that want to be in this career, and it's very few places to actually be taken up, because there's only so much, you know, so many actors and so many, you know, especially like Hollywood superstar actors to be in there. So that's, I agree there, the term should be breaking into, because it is something hard to break into. Tech, on the other hand, I don't think so. And I think we have created sort of artificially this idea that we are a Hollywood of careers, and only if you're one of the lucky few you can get in, which is absolutely not the case. And I don't like that as a terminology and as a mindset, like as a perspective on that. But I find it funny that you say that you've stumbled into it. Because in reality, and I don't think of, you know, we're going to talk about our individual stories, but I didn't stumble into tech. Mine was a very conscious decision, which was, I need to make money.
Fair. Okay. I guess the stumbling into, falling into applies, and I'm interested to know, and what I don't want to do is just have the next hour be, we each tell our stories of how we got to where we are, because personally for me, I know I have done that and told that elsewhere. I'm sure you have too. I'm more interested in the sort of external factors and environmental factors that you feel like, and I know I feel like, that put me on this path to where I am now. Because when I look back at how I got to this point in my career, very little of it was intentional. By which I mean, I didn't have a... If you'd asked me a year ago, 2 years ago, 5 years ago, where do you want to be? I wouldn't have said, here, doing what I'm doing now. I would have said something else. And it's not that I don't want to do what I'm doing now, it's that I didn't know that's where I'd end up. And so again, yeah. I think it sets up the wrong mentality.
Absolutely same thing here. I like your idea of not going through our story, because you're right, and we have spoken about it, and I think we've given tidbits here and there on this podcast as well. I like the external environment perspective, because what were the things that happened around us to push us in the direction that we are at right now? And by the way, just for clarity, like, I also did not plan for my career to go where it is right now. I think technically, right, so I'm 28, so I started like I started my quote-unquote tech career at 19, so that's what, like nine years. So I've always been in tech, so I haven't had any other career and or aspiration really since graduating high school. But by the way, like also the plan was not in high school to get into tech. I wasn't, that wasn't the path that was given to me. Like I didn't have that runway of like, oh, you're very techy since a very young age. Obviously you need to go to a technical school and then go into a technical university and then become a technical person, right? That was not the case at all. But it was the realization at the time, and it was the market at the time, that especially in Eastern Europe, and when I moved to Denmark, also in the West, where were the best salaries as, you know, a kid that was, you know, I wouldn't say like in a, you know, bad financial situation, like, you know, we were okay, but most people coming from Eastern Europe, we can, you know, sort of say like, yeah, you will struggle financially a little bit in comparison to most other folks. So being able to have a financially stable career was top of mind for me when I was making the decisions I was making. I'll tell this little bit of the story of how I got into tech, because I think that's really important. Because again, it's not breaking into, it's listening to the people around you. Getting into tech for me was, and that's maybe like the only stumbling thing I did, which is like I went to an open house event for a university in Denmark, and that's where I met my future lecturer at the time, who just said the right things to me in the span of a 10-minute conversation to convince me that this is the right path for me to choose, which it was networking, right? So network engineering like degree. And that was, that I think was the moment for me, which was the stumbling into, because it wasn't a planned event. It wasn't something that I was sort of like considering at the time. Like I was thinking more into going into like digital marketing, web design, web development, that sort of area of tech. I still, again, it's still tech. I still could consider that is where most of the money would be. It was just this more technical route that I didn't even know existed was then presented to me in a very brief amount of time, and then everything else, it felt like from that point on everything else fell into place. And I think it's and I'm very curious to hear that, did you have, or because I know most likely you did have that moment, but when was the pivotal moment, and what was the external factor that made you think, okay, this is not, I am now gonna step into a career in tech?
It came quite late for me, so probably around 2017, 2018. And prior to that, I'd been in a various kind of support roles. I'd done a bit of web design, like you say, but I'd always seen those jobs as a means to an end, as a part end being money, right? I was like, I need money, therefore I will get a job. That was the kind of thing. I think it was the moment when I, yeah, like 2018 through 2017, 18, 19. It was that.
Sorry to interrupt. No. What was the intention then? If the IT jobs were a means to an end, what was the intention at the time that you had?
It's hard to know, right? I think initially it was like get money, right? It was get money, and then it was, okay, I'm now in this job, I'm in this path. So progression is progressing. This job is, you know, get my boss's job or go and do networking at another company, right? Progress. I think initially I thought about teaching. Then for a long time I had aspirations of going into publishing, doing something with writing. It just wasn't, but if you think tech as a career is hard to start and develop, there are a lot more routes into technology than there are into that space. And that really does not pay either. It's a really, really tough space to get into. And so I think the goal kind of quite quickly became, right, progress my career, like look for what, how can, it was always a, how can I kind of make more money? That was really where my head was at. Up until the point when I started doing projects, and I think I kind of pivoted from being like, okay, I'm doing like IT support, maybe I want to go and be a business analyst, which was a kind of job title I didn't really understand what it actually involved. I knew I was still wanting to do something kind of creative. I was still looking at going into, like you said, like digital marketing. And I did apply for a few jobs like that, but I never kind of got in, because I wasn't looking for grad level. I was looking for something like, but there's a time when I was like sort of late 20s, mid to late 20s kind of going, I would take an entry level position now if it got me in the right place. But it's very hard looking back, and I'm 34 now, going, What did I want to do 6 years ago? Because I don't really know what my plan was.
Yeah. No, but again, finding a job that will provide you a life and a livelihood. I think that genuinely that was my only intention at the time as well. I didn't have, let's say, a career aspiration to be something completely different, and then suddenly pivoted into tech. It was like no. That was the intention, right? The direction was tech. It was just about which flavor of tech at the time. And I think this sort of route of wanting to do something that's more, I guess, like human friendly is a very typical one, which is because those are the things that we are more exposed to, right? We know what a website is, thus web development and design is something that, you know, is more familiar to us. I'm surprised data analysis was something that you were familiar with, because, you know, completely honestly, that is something that I got familiar with just a couple of years ago, right? I didn't know what a data analyst job actually entailed. Until recently, and I was just like looking in again recently, like a couple of years back. It makes sense that most of us would potentially like sort of like go into one intention and just say like, oh, this is now going to be a stepping stone into something that's going to pay better. But then suddenly finding ourselves into something completely different because, oh, actually, this is a better route for us. And I'm very pleased, by the way. Like, I have zero regrets in my careers of the decisions I have made. Every step along the way, you know, at the time it was always, and it genuinely felt like with every decision I made, it felt like a coin flip. Like, it can either go really well or it can go really poorly. Networking, like getting into an education with networking was definitely felt like one of those because it was again both a really good timing, but then also at the time I didn't realize that tech practically goes in a circle or a very tight coil. Right as I was getting into networking, there was this huge thing about automation. We're still talking about this, so nothing has changed, and networking jobs are still very, you know, very much sought after. The robots have not taken over our jobs yet. And I remember like going into those classes, and like I think it was the second semester when we were immediately started talking about automation. I'm like, ooh, did I make a mistake here? Did I went down into, and again at the time I just didn't have the knowledge to understand this, into a career that's fairly straightforward and simple, that is easily automatable, and I have now just wasted potentially like 2 years of my life and a degree that's not going to be helpful for me. Should I then pivot into something else? I'm very happy I didn't, because I immediately found a job after university, the same place I did my internship in, and became practically, and like knowing your story and sort of like I think in IT you took the more traditional route, which is help desk, projects, and then into pre-sales.
Yeah.
I skipped, and I think I still don't know if that was a good thing or a bad thing. Only time will tell throughout my career. I skipped those first levels because of the degree. And I was just welcomed into that company as a network engineer, like a full-fledged network engineer. I still had a lot of learning to do, mind you. Like, it wasn't a ta-da, like, you know, you've skipped level three. It's like, no, there were still a lot of things I needed to fill the gaps in.
I think it's for me, again, it's that thing of, it comes back to why I don't like the phrase, because I if people ask me, how do you break into tech? I actually feel like a fraud, because I feel like I just turned up one day and was like, oh, hang on, I'm now in this job. And your analogy of a coin flip is so true, because so many things in my career, and if I go back through my decisions, right, to go and work, to, the first, like, help job that kind of turned into a help desk job, that happened because I was having a coffee with some friends who I knew had a company, and I said, hey, do you want someone to come and do your web copy for you? And then that turned into a job. And then when that was kind of coming to a point where I was like, this isn't sustainable anymore, they were able to basically just give me an incredible reference to go and get my next job, which is still a help desk role. And then, you know, when I kind of, then at that point, and then it was like, the recruiter's saying, hey, actually, interestingly enough, the job that was with what became Loftware, I always remember and I haven't told this story that much, the recruiter contacted me initially, I think in like the January, and said, oh, there's this job and this person, and they're coming down from London and they're there for like 2 days. And I was like, I'm not available. For some reason, I couldn't do it. And I went, doesn't sound interesting to me. Right. They hired somebody else who lasted like 3 weeks. And so then it came around again. And I didn't realize at the time it was the same. And I never had confirmation it was the same job, but I was like, the same job. And the recruiter contacted me. He said, oh, this job, we'd like to put you forward. And I said, yep, sounds good. And I put in, and I looked, and I was like, right, it's going to be on the Friday in London. And I booked the train ticket. And she phoned me back. I was like, I've already booked my train ticket. And she was like, oh, that's good, because they want to interview you. So I hadn't even had the interview confirmed, and I booked the train ticket. And I feel like the statute of limitations, that's not really a thing, right? But I feel like it's passed now. So this is the one and only time that I pulled a sickie to get an interview, to go to an interview. Right. And it was on a Friday. Thankfully, the interview was on a Friday. And my manager was out of the office that week. But I knew that I had to start feeling unwell on, like, the Tuesday to, like, make it semi-believable. The worst part of this, and a little bit of me still feels bad to this day, and I'm not going to mention any name, because I doubt the person who did this will ever hear this, but if they did, they will know who they are, and for this, I am eternally sorry. It was the only time I ever worked like in an actual office setting, and quite often at lunchtime, this person would go to Costa to go, and they would go and get a drink. He'd always be like, oh, you know, do you want a drink? And I was normally like, no, I'm fine. This day, I'd said, I think this was like the Thursday, I was like, oh, I'm not feeling great. They came back and they're like, oh, I got you a hot chocolate because I know you said you're not feeling very good. Aww. And I just felt like the worst person in the world. And anyway, and I was, like just crawl up inside myself. And anyway, and then I had to do the phone call the next day and be like, yeah, I'm not feeling very well. Slightly panic that I had to go to the train station, which was in the same town as where the office was, so there was a chance I would get seen.
Oh, you were proper paranoid as well.
Yeah, right. Then I was like, but I was at the interview like an hour and a half early, and I just remember like turning up this, like, it was like an agency in London with like the kind of thing with like the light bulbs hanging from the ceiling and that kind of setting. Right. And I just remember that. And again, I remember kind of taking that risk. And the point kind of is that like in that moment, I took that risk and I was like, I don't know if this is going to pay off. And after that moment, I then was like, oh, I'll try this. And I did. And then I, again, the thing of when I was sat in a room with my, at the time, director, and he was like, oh, well, I'm going to do split pre and post sales. And I said, and I know I said this, oh, I definitely don't want to do pre-sale. A year later.
Thank you. I'm not a salesperson. I don't want to.
And credit to him, he was persistent and he knows this, and I owe him my career. Like, I have said to him on multiple occasions, and he's now a good friend of mine. And I'm like, no, I still, that thing of you should do this because you'll be good at this. And I just took that risk. And again, I've sort of come to now the attitude of the, like, why the fuck not when it comes to making these decisions? Because, like, when you look at everything and you look at going for a promotion, why the fuck not? The worst thing you're going to get is told no, and at the very least, you put yourself out there. And I just take that approach now to so many things. But I've never intentionally gone, here is my strategy for how I'm going to get.
Yeah. It's really funny they just say like a strategy. Like every single time I've made a career plan, like I feel like the moment I made a career plan was the moment that it pivoted. Mm-hmm. So when I was having my network engineering job, I had a plan because especially like network engineering, it tends to be, or it was at least at the time, there was a very structured promotional path that you know it started usually with help desk. Obviously I skipped that part. Then you are a junior, you know, intermediate, senior network engineer. Then you become an architect, you know, and then you become awesome. And that was really like my plan. Was that, okay, so the next step is going to be senior network engineer, that I wanted to get some projects on board, like I wanted to lead some projects to work towards that architect title and role. Also, like, you know, gathering knowledge, all, you know, throughout that point. I think the about the time I made that plan was like 2019. Because I remember speaking to our at the time architect, who I looked up, you know, and he's an amazing friend nowadays. And I very clearly remember having this conversation with him, where he is like, I sort of laid this out to him as my plan, and I had like some years attached to it. It's like, you know, oh, senior network engineer, like on average takes about, you know, 3 to 4 years. And he sort of like looked at me and went like, you don't know, you can be an architect now because you have the skill sets outside of the technical knowledge to be that person. And I told him, like, and again at the time I was like, what, 20, 25, 26, and I'm like, oh, me, like little old me, like, mm-hmm, no, mm-hmm. no, like I'm not, you know, I don't know, like, especially like talking to him, I'm like, buddy, like I don't know like 70% of what you know, like I am faking most of this, like I look up things all the time, like all of these certs, like I'm studying like crazy to get, like I'm not naturally that good at this stuff. And especially because I had the incredible luck of being surrounded by incredibly technical people who knew their stuff. Like I had a, and I don't know if I tell the story before, but I had an amazing colleague at the time who was taking individual networking packets. Right. So for folks that are not familiar with networking, like usually the communication between machines happens with things called packets at a certain level. I'm greatly oversimplifying this, but for the sake of the story. So he was taking these packets, which are practically can be divided into bits. Right. Which is like the smallest unit, one of the smallest units you can like divide data into. And he was taking it bit by bit and identifying all of the different parts of the packet. And I was looking at him, like, I would look over his shoulder and I would go like, you are a madman to be doing this. I have no interest in doing this stuff. That was about at the time where I was starting to think of like, ooh, is this job for me? Like, am I really, you know, am I technical enough? Do I care about this stuff enough to be? Because again, and everyone around me was like this. They were so incredibly technical and so incredibly knowledgeable in what they were doing. And I was starting to get like really bad imposter syndrome at that point. And that was also when I was having the conversation with my architect friend. And he would say like, and he would say this stuff and I'm like, absolutely not, right? Like, that's not, you're not talking to the right person here. And it was May time of 2020, right in lockdown. We were made like a big part of the team was furloughed, which in the UK, like it was a thing in the UK, which practically meant that you were getting a part of your salary, like a big part of your salary, but you were practically sent home on leave, you know. And you know, we used that time to do a lot of studying. We were doing a lot of certs at the time. And that was when I got the call from VMware for a pre-sales role. And that's really when the imposter syndrome kicked in. And it was just like, oh, me? Have you seen my profile? Like, what stuff? Because like they obviously use like the very HR thing of like, oh, we are looking for a profile exactly like yours. And I'm like, are you though? Like, do you know what you're getting yourself into? Like, I have no architect experience. Like, I've only, so silly, like, looking back at it now, like, I've only designed, like, two data centers. Like, it's not, like, I don't have, like, this, you know, huge experience that you expect me to have. And they're like, no, it's about character. It's about, like, you know, fundamental knowledge that you have about certain technologies. And it's, you know, and we will teach you about the product. We'll teach you about this. We'll teach you about that. And I'm like, And especially, it was a very weird time back then, and you know, speaking about the coin flip, that felt like a huge coin flip, and it did genuinely feel 50-50, because for the longest of time I wasn't going to take the offer, because it was almost like 45, you know, 55, like it wasn't a 50-50 at the time, because I would see, I think Microsoft at the time and Amazon, like they were hiring engineers and then laying them off like a month later because they underestimated how much work they're going to get over the pandemic and everything. So it was a very volatile time in tech. And I'm like, am I going to ruin a secure space that I have? Because after the furlough, they were going to bring us all back into the office. Am I going to remove the security blanket I have for the potential chance of going to work for a vendor? And it was months of many a walks and many a conversations with different people to like, is this risk worth taking? And at the time it almost felt like I just woke up one morning and it genuinely felt like a coin flip. It's like I woke up one morning and I said like, no, I'm gonna do it. I just called my mom to check in if she is going to be okay with me going back home in case everything goes, you know, if nothing goes right. She said yes, and I was like, okay, I'm gonna go for it and see what happens. So you can't argue. I guess you can make the argument that I did sort of stumble into tech in that sense of like, oh, I got an amazing offer throughout my career, like to be in positions that are very well paid and very, you know, and given me the chance to learn and really, you know, better my skill sets to be able to push forward. Or you can just say that, you know, because like, for example, one of the reasons they even found me was that I was very active on LinkedIn. Right. And I don't want to keep on tooting this horn of like, you know, oh, you need to have a brand and, you know, people need to see you. But that was genuinely the reason. Like, the recruiter at the time quoted, like she said, I saw your LinkedIn profile pop up because you're doing these, you know, interesting things. And then I saw the skill sets you have set up in that LinkedIn profile. And that's why we want to talk to you. It's like, oh, okay, interesting. Right. So, did I stumble into it? Maybe.
I think maybe. Likewise, I every time I've set out a career plan, it's never gone the way I imagined. It's always gone, and it's always been like, oh, I didn't expect this to happen. This is actually so much more exciting than what I thought I could end up doing. No, maybe you kind of did. I want to just touch on what you said about being active on LinkedIn. Because, yes, it feels like we talk about it a lot, but it is so important. And the other thing is just literally going and like registering your CV with job sites. I have had job offers and jobs that have come out of just having my CV on job sites. It does remind me that I need to update it when I'm still getting job offers for like third line help desk roles, which makes me wonder which job site is it that's my CV from like 10 years ago is still floating on. But it's worth doing that. And I think there's an element of like putting yourself out there. And it's like when I got my, you know, when I was a teenager trying to get a job in like a store, just literally printing my CV off and going in and handing it around and going, do you have any jobs? Like, I think there's a putting yourself out there. And again, being a bit more curated about it, but do, because people do look at those platforms and recruiters do use it, right? And they do search and use those key terms. But I guess where I kind of wanted to sort of come to is if someone now, and I've had a few conversations with people who are like, oh, tell me how you broke into tech and how I can do it. And I think that's where the kind of the fraudulent feeling comes from, because I'm like, I just stumbled into this. But interestingly enough, as we're kind of talking this out, and I feel like you've had a similar thing to me on this, I'm interested to hear your view, is I feel like, yes, absolutely, luck and opportunity have been a huge part of how I've ended up where I am. But the reason that I have done that is I have been looking for those opportunities and I have taken them and I have seen and been willing to try things.
Absolutely. I even have a thing I kept on saying to people, and I've been very lucky in my career to have multiple mentees mm-hmm. as well as mentors. But to the mentees, that's the one thing I kept on saying to them, which is say yes to every conversation, to every opportunity to meet more people. So, because I had a thing, like I wasn't actively looking for jobs. I to be honest with you, like I've been lucky enough to never have to actively be looking for a job, but I was always open to a conversation. Right? Any recruiter, any company, any acquaintance that I had that was like reached out to me and went like, oh, there's this opportunity that I would love to talk to you about that. I absolutely had the conversation. There is nothing wrong in having the conversation. And there's multiple reasons for that, because one, you know, even if you are very happy with where you are, I think it's really important to know what is out there in the market, at the very least to know, am I being paid fairly? Am I doing, you know, interesting things? Like, am I doing the things that are now being searched for in the market? Because it might not be, again, you might be happy with your salary. So there's always a benefit to that conversation, because they might say, oh, we think you're a good fit for this other role. It's like, oh, why is that? Oh, because of these skill sets. Oh, interesting. That means that they are more marketable at the moment. Maybe in my day-to-day, I should focus more on that side of things. And I'll give you a perfect example. Like, I did that in my pre-sales role. Like, even though I was an individual contributor, there was a huge push for people who knew how to set up projects and manage projects and work together with different groups within the organization. It's like, oh, okay, I'm not a manager, right? I'm not a leader, but those skills seems to be very valuable out there in the open market. Why don't I, on my own account, start a couple of projects internally, get people on board, get people excited to do this one. For example, like we did a poster, like a security poster for all of the products within VMware. And that was something that I drove to a huge degree with the help of amazing people within VMware at the time. But that was something that now I have as a skill set to say, okay, if I am to look for another job, which hopefully I won't have to, and the business is going to work out, but if I do, this is now something that I have as an experience that I have done, which came from a conversation with a recruiter that was trying to get to you know, get me out of VMware. And they said those skills in particular were in high demand. It's like, oh, interesting, right? Let me embed that into my day-to-day. So, oh, like if I was to give, you know, some piece of, yeah, like any recommendation is, yeah, LinkedIn is fine. Don't bet on only LinkedIn, though. Meet people, go to events, talk to people about yourself. And I know, especially in the UK, that the people find it extremely hard to like sort of sell themselves. which, you know, in the UK, folks are very humble and very sort of like they don't put themselves out there as much, which they absolutely should, because I have met some amazing people out there that never say a peep of what they're doing. And there I am as a cheerleader with the pom poms. It's like, yeah, buddy, you're the best. Right? It's like you need a Lydia in your life practically if you are going to be like that. Or use a little bit of that cheerleader energy to put yourself out there. So LinkedIn is one thing. Meeting people and talking to them is another. Always being open to conversations with recruiters, even if you're not currently looking. And be honest with them, right? Like, I was always very sort of forward and you know, open to them about like my current situation. Because they would ask me like, oh, are you happy with where you are right now? And I'll be like, extremely, right? And I have so much to do in this company. But I'm still, if you are happy to have this conversation, I'm happy for us to have this conversation, even if it's something for us to look into the future. right? Because, you know, you never know what's going to happen in a couple of years' time, potentially being acquired and, you know, being made redundant. So, you know, who knows? It's definitely
an opportunity. Who knows? Who knows? Who knows? And it's that thing, and I this is not an original idea, and I've heard it from multiple people, but it's this idea, and we've spoken on the show before about looking at yourself as a business. We talked about it last episode, being an individual, seeing yourself as running a business, seeing the department. Look at those things as building your pipeline. Like, what opportunities are out there, putting yourself out there to potentially, and it's not that you're going to land everything, but it might be that one of those things comes along and you go, hey, you know what, this is actually the right timing. And I, like you, I've only ever had one time in my career where I was like, I need a job because I'm going to be out of work. And that was over 10 years ago. Every other time, I've been able to make that jump from a fairly happy place, not always, not entirely, but not an insecure place. Not a place where I was like, I'm gonna be, you know, there's always been a solution, but it's just kind of not, maybe really things maybe haven't been going the way I hoped they would. And then an opportunity has come along and I'm like, oh, right, I'm gonna go and take that. And that's the final thing really on this is, are you familiar with soft power and what that means? Okay, so it's a term that's used in politics more, but there's a contrast between soft and hard power. Hard power, in a political sense, is like, you have nuclear weapons, which is a threat. You have a big army. You are a powerful country. Right, right. A context of that in a company is, you have a big title, you are selling big deals, you're doing very powerful, obvious things that people look to, and you go, here are all the things that I have that I've done. Soft power is relationships. It's how you're seen as a person. So if a country has lots of soft power, it means they have good diplomatic relationships with other countries. If you have good soft power internally, it's everything you've been talking about that you did at VMware and other companies, which is building up that kind of personal brand and how you're thought of in the company. And it's doing things in a way that is not about, it's not about going, I'm going to do this and therefore I'm going to get a promotion, or I'm going to do this and therefore I'm going to get this job. But it's doing things which elevate your soft power, which means that when you come to ask somebody for something, they're more willing to do that for you because they think, hey, you know what, Lydia's great, right? I want to do something, but I want to help her. And I think that's another thing to really think about, being intentional with what you do and look at it in those contexts and go, well, yeah, okay, this may not secure me a pay rise this year. It may not get me the promotion this year. But actually, if this is going to reinforce across the business with people who I don't really engage with, if they know my name, if I'm a recognizable face, when an opportunity comes up internally as well as externally, you're going to be in a better place to be considered for that because you're going to be thought of very highly in the company. And that will also mean that people, even if they are saying, hey, you know what, you're not quite the right fit for this job, but there's actually something over here which we think you'd be really good at doing, which is an experience that I've had. And it is incredibly gratifying because it's like, oh, I've not gotten the role that I thought I was going to get. But actually, I've been given an opportunity to go and do something, and what the leadership have recognized in me is a set of skills that I have that will be well suited. And that then opens up another opportunity. So in terms of breaking into tech, breaking into sales, it's hard to do. It's obviously kind of trying to get into a company is always harder than doing it from the inside. But there's a lot more routes in, I would say. And I think we've obviously talked about our own kind of routes in, and those are, as you say, it's like maybe some of the more traditional ones. But there's lots of other things that you can do to get yourself in, and there's lots of other skills that people have that can get them in, get inside a company. And then you just have to look and go and have those conversations. Ask people for virtual coffees. Right? People will give you 15, 30 minutes of their time. If you're working in Europe and, I don't know, you're in professional services and you're thinking I'd love to break into sales, you're going to know who your VP of sales is for that region. They might not know you, but you'll know who they are. Ask them and say, hey, I'm really interested. I would love to know what I can do now that is going to put me in a good position. And if you have any openings coming up for suitable roles, I would love to be considered. And I think putting yourself in the best position to take advantage of the opportunity when it comes along is
absolutely. And also on that front of like having coffee chats with people, always feel free to reach out to both me and Paul if you are thinking about something, if you are looking into some changes, if you're looking into anything, we both have the time. We'll always have the time, because I think I speak for the both of us. We have found so much value and in just having seemingly casual conversations with people that we look up to, or we are looking at and go like, hey, I love your career, like, how can I do that? So what I'm saying is, like, it doesn't have to be internally within your own company, because sometimes there isn't a space or a trajectory within that company. But, and by the way, the only way to know that is to ask. And if the answer is no, sorry, like, we are at capacity, or this is not the direction we're taking as a company, that is completely fine from your perspective, because the community out there of people who are doing, have done, and will do what you want to do are out there. You know, find your allies, find people that can really help you and motivate you. I think a lot of this is also confidence, like, and just give you the little bit of boost that you need to say, like, actually, I'm not an aspiring, and I see a lot of folks doing this on LinkedIn, and absolutely no shade to that, but don't put aspiring SE, just put, you know, looking for a role as an SE or anything. That you're not an aspiring anything, you already are that, you just need the role to fill it in. So absolutely, like, be confident in what you want to do, be confident in the direction you want your career to take, and again, you never know. It might turn out that you were looking into becoming an architect in 20 years. It might happen that you will do the exact same role with a different title in within the same year.
It's that time of the week again. AI therapy.
Therapy.
We need a jingle. At some point we'll have
it. So, Paul.
So, Lydia. AI therapy.
Tell me. Talk to me.
Talk to you.
What's wrong this week?
Nothing.
Everything is wrong.
Where do I start? What goes right? No, this is a weird one. Like, this is because I feel like this segment has a lot of it's been about, like, ha, funny story, things AI is not working very well. This is kind of the inverse of that, which is I've been playing more with ChatGPT recently, and I think since they released a 4.0 to public access, I think it's still limited, but I don't use it, like, enough.
What prompted you to start playing with it a bit more now?
Honestly, the fact that I have a phone with an action button that I can link to it, I've been using Arc Browser, which does the, like, AI summaries, but I was also just playing with it, and it does this, so it will, if I press and hold, and then it starts the voice conversation. Hi, ChatGPT. How are you today?
Hi, thanks for asking. How about you?
So it's like the text-to-speech, speech-to-text, but it does that. But I've actually been using it, again, kind of quite mundane things. I think I had a few times when I was, like, trying to solve some stuff in my garden, and Google just was not really helping. And I think some of it is the fact that search. So I just started playing with it. The fact that 4.0 was made, like, available to everybody, I thought, let's have a play with this, because I'm not paying for it. I think that's the thing, is that when I was paying for it, I wasn't getting enough value out of it to pay for it, and the free version was not good enough to use. Now, what was the paid version with the plugins and everything is freely available. Hey, more use. Cool stuff. Let's play. Yeah. Let's use the Canva integration, which is very cool. But
I haven't used that. You and I have talked about that. But, to let you know, my recent ChatGPT usage has been to learn how to scrape dynamic websites, which I think I sent you, like, a couple of screenshots, and you just said, I don't know what this is, and I don't want to be involved.
Yes, yes, that was it. Yeah. I was like, okay, this is the thing you're sending me.
Yep. There's some scripts there. Yep, you're running some scripts.
The quote was, those are some words that you've said. Yeah. But I did in my endeavors, I was like, oh, just going through the ChatGPT, like the plugins library. I was just playing, and I thought, let's have a play. And I was like, oh, there's one that's video GPT. And I hadn't sort of up to this point tried any video stuff. And within about 5 minutes, it had written and created an albeit not very good video, but it still did it in about 5 minutes, and I went, ooh, that's a little bit uncomfortable. And it was the kind of one that I've seen, which is the robotic text-to-speech voice over some stock imagery, but the kind of thing that you see a lot of it, and it's also the kind of thing that you see a lot of it going down a certain sort of conspiracy pipeline online But I was like, oh, no.
Did it touch the uncanny valley? Is that what
you feel like? No, it wasn't kind of uncanny valley. It was obviously that it wasn't a human speaking. But it was the speed and ease with which I was able to make it. And it was the fact that I went, if I wanted to, this would be a very easy way to create hundreds and hundreds of videos to put onto a platform like Instagram or TikTok. TikTok is the example I would kind of in my head, because knowing how it monetizes feeds and that, like, it sort of pays per view, essentially. And maybe I'm giving away a quote-unquote free side hustle here. If you want to go and do this, be my guest, go and do this, because I just do not want
to
have...
Oh, people have most likely already figured it out.
Oh, yeah, they do. Yeah. And it is. But I think I also was like, oh, hang on. There's a lot... I kind of knew that AI was becoming more insidious on these platforms and is kind of bleeding into YouTube as well. But I think it was that moment when I went, oh no, hang on, there's a lot of this. Like, the majority of the content now. It's not every five or six, it's most of it. And there's some stuff with video, and I've seen a few clips of people doing, like, the AI video edit. So when you have, again, like a podcast recording when it's done in the studio and you have a three-way camera edit, and it's like you film those three cameras and it says, hey, just create me a three camera edit. Now, there is a whole industry there that I worry for. But again, I see that as being an augmentation rather than a replacement. But it was just, I don't know. It just sort of made me feel a little bit like, oh, okay. I thought we were further away from this than we actually are.
Right.
But just, yeah, I don't know. It just was that like, oh, this was kind of weirdly... That was really easy. And are we going from AI being... I feel like we've gone from this novelty of when ChatGPT first launched in 2022 to everyone kind of having a moral panic about it and everyone writing everything on LinkedIn and social media using AI, to now in a space where, yeah, people still use AI-generated images, and every time I see an AI-generated image on my feed, rest assured I will look at it and I will find the really bizarre words that it's pulled up. Recent example, AI not being able to spell manufacturing. Just like kind of quite sloppy stuff that I will call out on those areas. But I was like, oh no, actually there's applications for it in productivity and usability and summarization and research. And I still think that's there. But yeah, it was just a bit...
I just realised, it wasn't you who sent me the link to the AI-only news channel. Do you know of this?
No.
You know what I'm talking about?
No.
Oh my lord, how did you miss this? I thought you were going down that route.
Oh.
So, I need to find... I'll find a link to this and then we'll post it in the show notes. But I saw a video promoting the world's first 24/7 AI-driven news site, where the reports were AI written, the research was AI done, the visuals, aka like the presenters, the voice, everything was made automatically for using AI tools. I thought you've seen this, because
no.
Like, to me that was like...
That's...
Did you look it up?
Well,
see it?
No, well, yeah, I'm gonna do it. Yeah, AI news channel.
Yeah, look it up. Look it up
right
now.
News channel. Noisy clicky keyboard. Channel 1 AI. AI news. The world's first AI generated... Oh. I suppose I would be more concerned about this if there wasn't already huge numbers of actual people doing this kind of stuff. And in some ways, I would almost be more trustworthy of the AI than I would be of some of the news.
Yeah, because at least it's stating it, right? It's like, this is all AI generated.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not...
I see where you're coming with the comfort, but seeing the video, like, the trailer for it was incredibly uncomfortable.
That's where I thought
you were going with generating videos.
I'm watching it now, and it's literally one of the presenters is just doing this. So
yes,
it reminds me of the, like, in the Disney World, there's the It's a Small World. And, like, when you go around and it's, like, animatronics of people sort of, they're picking up a phone going like this, right? And it's that, and I'm just like,
yep,
that's
just
what it looks like. It's just
phone,
it's just
yep.
Raising the phone, moving hands out, moving hands in, moving hands out, moving hands in. I mean,
a human animatronic.
Yeah.
I think we've done enough horror games to know why this is incredibly uncomfortable to watch. I clocked in on that as well. If folks, like, we're going to post a link in the notes with this, because it, I think, is worth watching for the sake of, first of all, yes, things have moved on quite quickly with this whole, like, generating stuff, but also, this is what I was referring to maybe earlier, because as you were describing things to me, like, that was the video that was playing in my head, and that's where the uncanny valley kicked in, because, yeah, you look very human, but also you're an animatronic, and that is incredibly uncomfortable to watch. And to the point about, first of all, like, I'm not even going to go down the rabbit hole of, like, our news site supposed to be 24/7, like, that's already, like, why is a news channel 24/7? There should not enough things happen that will affect you as a person that need to be spilled at you 24/7. I have a whole thing about, like, why I don't read news and why I don't get involved with a lot of these things, exactly for this reason. We have a limited amount of care that we can give for the world. It should be for the things that you can change and that should matter to you. You know, limit your news intake, people. Highly recommend it. But honestly, that one clip was enough to, like, make me go, like, that is the final stage of news and I want none of that. Incredible technology, uncomfortable output.
Yeah. I'm gonna link an article as well, which is about the like, this idea of the internet in 2029 and when everything is kind of all gone. Also, shameless self-promotion, I'm going to link to my Substack and my latest post, which expands on the topic we talked about a few episodes back, about the internet getting smaller and online spaces. So kind of tangential. I had a lot of fun writing it. It's something I wanted to write for a long time, so I hope that people enjoy it. But just some reading to take in. And I would once again encourage people to look at everything on the internet with a critical eye. And I do find it wonderfully ironic that the generation who raised us, telling us just because you read it on the internet does not mean it's true, are now the people who are most likely to believe some news from a BS Facebook page. I saw it on Facebook. It was on WhatsApp. Okay, probably not true.
Stay critical, folks. Stay critical.
If you listen to podcasts for any amount of time, you will know that they at the end go, hey everyone, if you enjoy this, like, subscribe and rate. Full disclosure, we had not appreciated that actually that does impact things quite a lot. So if you're enjoying this show, and we're really glad that you are, and we're so grateful to everyone that listens, please like it, please subscribe, and please give us a rating and a review on whichever platform you're using, be it Spotify or Apple Podcasts or our personal favourite, Overcast.
Thank you so much for listening, folks.